Let's pray before we look into the scripture. Gracious God, we are grateful for new beginnings. We're grateful for fresh expressions of faith, new steps in your direction. We pray that not only for our confirmands, but for us as we continue to live out what it means to be baptized ones, that we are loved by you, embraced by you, chosen by you to be disciples, to make disciples, to love as you, our risen Lord, have loved, and to hear your voice. So allow us this evening, through the scriptures you've given us, through the spirit that inspired them, through the humans that wrote them, through all this shared tradition and history that we have, teach us, lead us, give us hope, courage, strength, faith, hope, love. We ask this in the name of Christ. Amen. All right, you should have, and many of you may not, there's in your vicinity, if you don't have a Bible underneath your seats or underneath the seat in front of you, the ones you have out in the chairs are NRSVs. We've been using the NIV because, and you guys probably remember, 2 years ago, we started on Matthew. And the confirmands had to come to this service or come to Sunday service, or I think both. And so we had some of you in here. You would have been here when we started Matthew, the very first session. And we talked about the three major sections of Matthew and the five great sayings where Jesus speaks for a long time. Any of you remember that? Well, guess what? We're still in Matthew. 2 years later, we're still in Matthew. We're almost done, if that's, you know, any consolation. But we are at the very, very end. I want to invite you to turn to Matthew chapter 27 as we follow up where we left off last week as we looked at the death of Christ last week. We came to that horrible crucifixion, the end of all the torture and the taunting and the cries. And now in our text, there is a quietness, almost a serenity to how the story is going to unfold, because all the loud cries of the victims of crucifixion are over. Jesus has made his loud cries, calling out to God and saying something that has unleashed the Spirit's power, as we looked at last week. The centurions around the cross have said, "Surely this was the Son of God," and they've completely changed their story to before, where they were beating him, taunting him, mocking him. They now have seen in him something that reminds them of royalty. Son of God was the name Caesar took upon himself. And they say, "Surely this is the Son of God." And so something has happened that is impacting everyone, but we're coming to the calm after the storm, and we find in this calm in verse 55 that there are some people that we haven't been paying too much attention to, but they've always been lurking there on the margins. Verse 55, "Many women were there, watching from a distance. They had followed Jesus from Galilee to care for his needs. Among them were Mary Magdalene, and Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of Zebedee's sons." So we have the presence of women. They're at a distance. We have no male presence. All of Jesus' disciples, at least in the story Matthew tells, are absent. They are not present, nowhere to be found. But instead we have the women, and we have them there for at least a couple of reasons. In ancient culture, in Jewish culture, they weren't allowed to be disciples. And yet Jesus has allowed that. He has given them this ability, but since in the culture they're not allowed to be disciples, they would not be perceived as co-conspirators with Jesus like the male disciples would have. So there wasn't quite as threat to their lives, but there still was threat. So there is courage in them looking from afar. And before our text is over in verse 56, the two Marys we're going to find go all the way to the tomb. When Joseph buries Jesus, we're going to find them on Sunday going and unexpectedly countering the risen Christ. So it's important that we see these women, and Matthew wants to include them now because the story is drawing to its close. There is another person that we've completely ignored all of Matthew's gospel. He doesn't come until this point in time. And his name is probably familiar to you, Joseph of Arimathea. Now, he only comes up a couple of times. John highlights him in one special text in John. But otherwise, in the Gospels, he doesn't come to the end because he's different than the other disciples. He's a secret disciple. He's a secret disciple because he's wealthy and because he has more to lose than the other disciples. He's also very influential in his community, which means he has some kind of way to encounter and influence those high up in power. So in verse 57, we read this, "As evening approaches," so there's still that calm and quiet, "there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who had himself become a disciple of Jesus. Going to Pilate, he asked for Jesus' body, and Pilate ordered that it be given to him." Now that's how we know that money talks. None of the disciples could have done this. None of the poor and the marginalized that Jesus has reached out to would ever get a hearing from Pilate. But there's something about Joseph and his money and his influence that allows him to have an inroad to even approach Pilate and to say, "Pilate, may I have his body?" Now, there's a big danger in doing that. Usually, if someone was crucified, they were considered the worst of the worst, and they'd be left there to rot on the cross until the carrion, the vultures, and others would pick their flesh off, and then the skeleton would fall off eventually. That makes a greater sign, because Rome's trying to say, don't mess with the power of Rome, and so if you leave the body up for days, that allows that message to carry on as long as you need it to. Sometimes the bodies would be taken down and tossed into the ground, tossed on a pile, and the carrion and vultures would have their way there. But this body's not going to end up on the ground or on a cross rotting. Instead, Joseph, who has the wealth, who has the power, approaches Pilate. And in his approaching Pilate, he is running a great risk, because he's proving to be a sympathizer with a condemned criminal guilty of rebellion against Rome. He's essentially saying, this person that I'd like to show respect to, the one that you have crucified, the one that you've perceived as such a threat to Roman peace that you've put him on the torture stake, I would like to show him respects in the Jewish way of having his body buried. Pilate agrees. Now, why does Pilate agree? We don't know. Did Joseph have that much influence? We all know that Pilate, previously in Matthew, had said, I find no fault in him. And yet, he feels like his hands are tied, even though he could have stopped the proceedings at any moment. We don't know why Pilate agrees, but Pilate does agree. And Joseph of Arimathea is allowed to take the body and to have it buried in the ancient Jewish tradition. Which is not like we do it. No coffins. No burnt ashes, but you would clean the body, you'd wrap it in a cloth with perfumes and spices, and then you'd put it in a cave, or if you had the money for it, you could buy a tomb, and Joseph has got some coin. You put it in a nice place where it can actually be secure. And so that's what takes place in verse 59 and forward. Joseph took the body, wrapped it in a clean linen cloth, and placed it in his own new tomb that he had cut out from the rock. He rolled a big stone in front of the entrance to the tomb and went away. And there lurking, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were sitting there opposite the tomb. So in the ancient Jewish tradition, you'd wrap the body, you'd put the perfumes, you'd put the spices, you'd put it on a shelf in either a cave or in a tomb. And he's made one, and this is a new one. And you'd put it there. And over time, the body would rot and the flesh would decay. And after months or years, you could then go back and retrieve the bones and put them in an ossuary. And that bone box or ossuary you could give to the family, and it would be like their urn for us if someone is cremated. So you could do that, and that's what he's doing. Oftentimes, you'd have 2, 3, 4, 5 bodies in one cave. It's important that Matthew wants us to see this is a new tomb. There's no other body here. It's just the body of Jesus. And it's not just a cave that anyone could get into. He's got a Cadillac of a tomb. He's rich. He has coin. It's a new tomb he's made. It wasn't made for Jesus. So that shows you how much haste there is. He wants to get the body buried before Sabbath begins. And it also shows the deep sense of affection he must have for Jesus. That this is perhaps for him or for a family member or someone deeply beloved. But in haste, he allows it to be used for Jesus. And it's a new tomb. And because it's the Cadillac version with all the bells and whistles, it has an incredibly large stone to be rolled over the top so that no grave robbers can get in, defile the body, or take any wealth that would be left on people as they were buried. We know there's none on Jesus, but tomb raiders don't know that. Especially when you've got a wealthy tomb like this. Who's to know what treasures there might be in raiding this tomb? Well, we find in verse 61 the two Marys are there. And that's important because it means they know where the tomb's at. They know exactly where Jesus is buried. One theory that wants to explain away Jesus' resurrection is the wrong tomb theory. That somehow Mary and Martha went to the wrong tomb on that Easter Sunday morning. And then, you know, once they told the people, the chief priests, they go to the wrong tomb. Everyone goes to the wrong tomb and the whole resurrection conspiracy arises because nobody really knew where the tomb was at. And Matthew is trying to make it very, very clear here. No, they're right there. They know where he's buried, so much so that they'll return on their own on that first Easter morn. Well, that's Friday. We come to the next day, verse 62, and Pilate isn't done being pestered. Because on the next day, verse 62, the one after preparation day, that's preparation for Sabbath, when the chief priest and the Pharisees ought to be resting, they're up to what we'll feel is no good, because we're reading it from a Christian perspective, what they feel is a good work. So it's the next day, the chief priest and the Pharisees went to Pilate. "Sir," they said, "we remember that while he was still alive, that deceiver said, 'After 3 days I will rise again.' So give the order for the tomb to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise, his disciples may come and steal the body and tell the people that he's been raised from the dead, and this last deception will be worse than the first." They're anxious. Their fears aren't relieved by the fact that Jesus didn't come down from the cross. Their whole system and way of doing things could be further affected if there's even a mere rumor of resurrection. And they seem to have taken Jesus' words far more seriously than the disciples ever did, because they at least recognized that he had said this where the disciples easily and conveniently forget it. And they also know that, well, we don't think he's going to rise, but the disciples may come and do something that causes a rumor of resurrection to allow this man, this dead man, to have more influence than he should. So they say, "We need constant surveillance. Let's have some surveillance so that nobody can mess with this tomb." And Pilate hears this and in verse 65 says, "Take a guard." I like what the Greek literally says. "You have a guard." Because there is a little bit of controversy over who this guard is. "You have a guard" could be Pilate saying, "Here are some Roman soldiers and they are yours." It could also be, "You have a guard," that is your temple guards, use them. Most commentaries I read, and I read a wide spectrum, will say that these are Roman soldiers, that he's giving them a certain amount of Roman soldiers, not just to how many we don't know, but he gives them a number of Roman soldiers and says this, and this is my favorite line in the whole story. "Take a guard," Pilate answered. "Go, make the tomb as secure as you know how." Make the tomb as secure as you can. Where we hear this, knowing how the story ends, yeah, good luck with that. Do all you can. As Frederick Buchner said, it's like a soldier shooting a machine gun into the wind to try to stop this. I mean, you go ahead, use all available means to try to stop God and God's plan here, but you're going to find that the best you can do is hardly enough. So he says, "Go, make it as secure as that you know how." The guard is posted, and in verse 60, they went and made the tomb secure by putting a seal on the stone and posting a guard. A seal on the stone would be something like a police tape. That'd be the best way for us moderns to think of it. In the ancient world, you could seal a letter and show that it wasn't opened by anyone but the intended recipient. The seals could be a cross like this. It could be a rope across the front. It could be a wax seal and wax seal against the stone and the actual wall. Some way to, you know, if you want to see if someone's sneaking out at night, you just tape a little hair across the door. And if you wake up and that hair's broken, you know that someone's got into it. That's the idea that's going on. The point is, at this time in our story, the so-called enemies of Christ that are trying to diminish his influence are doing everything possible to make sure that if something were to happen, they've done everything they can to prevent it. So that it's not just a tomb where there is no guard and nothing could happen and the disciples come and steal it away. They are making special measures to make sure that if something does happen, it's going to be more than just your average story. Now, verses 1 through 10 of chapter 28, we covered on Easter Sunday. And if you weren't here on Easter Sunday, and even if you were, I'm just going to read through it, no comment or minimal comment, because this is the Easter message. And so on that first Easter, we read this: after the Sabbath, at the dawn of the first day of the week, which would be Sunday, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to look at the tomb. There was a violent earthquake, for an angel of the Lord came down from heaven and, going to the tomb, rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning and his clothes were white as snow. The guards were so afraid of him that they shook and became like dead men. The angel said to the women, "Do not be afraid, for I know that you're looking for Jesus who was crucified. He is not here. He is risen, just as he said. Come and see the place where he lay. Then go quickly and tell the disciples he's risen from the dead and is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him. Now I have told you." So the women hurried away from the tomb, yet afraid, yet filled with joy, and ran to tell his disciples. Suddenly Jesus met them. "Greetings," he said. They came to him, clasped his feet, and worshipped him. Then Jesus said to them, "Do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee. There they will see me." So go back to home base. Tell all those brothers who denied and left me and fled, I want them to meet me again, which is an essential message of grace and forgiveness. Jesus wants to resume the relationship, but now it's on the order of a different level. Now it's with the risen Christ who has conquered death and triumphed over the grave. That's where we ended on Sunday morning. Where we're going to end today is that next paragraph. Because meanwhile, while they're running back, verse 11, while the women were on their way, some, not all of the guards, but some of the guards went into the city and reported to the chief priest everything that had happened. And I would love to have heard that report. You know, we were there, an earthquake started happening, and the lightning from the sky, and this strange being, and the stone rolled away, and there was this manifestation on top of the stone. And I think that's where it stopped. I don't think they'd say we were quaking in our boots like dead men. We were scared to death, we could hardly move, but these gals, they seem just fine. They're not including that part of the story, but they are reporting that they have seen something unusual, something so overwhelming that they've got to come back and report that they have failed in their job. So, at that point, verse 12, when the chief priest had met with the elders, they have a strategic meeting, they devised a plan. Now, you could stop right there. Because the tragedy of this story is, at this point, wouldn't it be nice if they say, "Oh my gosh, the deceiver may not have been a deceiver after all. There's this strange report and maybe we should follow up on it." But you have to assume that their hold and control over the temple and religion was so fierce that nothing, not even the awareness of this event, would allow them to loosen the grip on what they considered their role to be as the chief guardians of Israel's religion. So they met, they devised a plan, and like all plans that involve deception, the money comes out. They gave the soldiers a large sum of money. Literally, they gave them a large sum of silver. Judas got 30 pieces. We're meant to realize large sum means that we're talking about a big payout. Because they've got to say a story that is so crazy, you'll immediately see the holes in it. Verse 13, telling them, here's your story. Here's the spin control. Here's the bullet points. Here's what you're going to be saying when you talk to your superiors. You are to say, "His disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep." That's the story. Now, before we pick that apart, look at the next line. "If this report gets to the governor," that is Pilate, "we'll satisfy you and keep you out of trouble." The danger was that these men would have been seen as failing absolutely, and there'd be massive penalties to that, which could include court-martial, it could include execution, so that some soldiers, when they failed at their mission, they would just take their lives, because you don't want to have to go through the whole troubling process of being shamed in front of everyone. So they're going to have to tell their superiors they have failed in every possible way, and that's why the religious leaders say, "Hey, you know all that coin we just gave you? We got plenty more, and we know this, everyone has a price. And if we pay Pilate enough, we can probably get him to relieve you of any punishment that may come your way." If you ever want to know where corruption lies in any institution or organization, follow the money. The money has power. That is one of the terrifying aspects of it, that it carries with it a weight that will make even people who have seen miracles say, it didn't really happen, in order to maintain the status quo. So we have the money purse being brought out, but look at the report there to give. You're to say, verse 13, his disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep. Do you see the hole, the inconsistency, the poorness of this story? You do, don't you? If you don't, I'll say it, and it's probably obvious. If they're asleep, how do they know it's the disciples? That's the most obvious thing. You know, I was asleep and a dragon came and ate my homework. Well, how do you know? I was asleep. You were asleep, kid. Maybe I don't really have it. So that you're saying that you're asleep and pointing out the person that did it. The problem with that is that story is already a problem. Add to this, the disciples would have to roll this 1 to 2 ton stone, you know, and make all kinds of noise while they're doing this. And you slept through that, trained military men, guards who are strong, who have, I mean, that's really a troubling story. But, you know, the alternative is if they're awake, if they were to make the story, you know, we were awake and the disciples came upon us and beat us and then took off with Jesus. You'd have to wonder a couple things. Why couldn't they take the disciples? These are armed soldiers. And then you'd have to wonder, what is it that made these disciples who cower in fear, run from Jesus, not want anything to do with the crucifixion, all of a sudden in the space of 2 days, muster up the courage and say, let's go take on the Roman army. I mean, listen, come on. They got swords, they got shields, they got armor, but hey, we can take them. Even Peter's not that crazy. So that you end up with stories, no matter which way you go, that make this spin very easily seen as nothing more than spin. It's just putting a spin, and spin is always there to distract us from the truth. It's there to spin it in such a way that we really don't see enough of what's going on, and we end up, you know, sympathizing with however someone wants us to hear the story. And that's what these religious leaders are doing. And the saddest part of all is I am one of them. I'm part of that crowd. That they are so desperate to maintain their illusion of control that they hope that with a few bribes, with everyone having their price, that they can maintain that illusion of control, even if it means deceiving everyone. They don't care if the message is bogus. And all of a sudden, you realize they said in verse 63, we remember while he was still alive, that deceiver said. Well, look who is the deceiver now. And they know they're deceiving. At least Jesus could be excused for being someone who may have thought he was the Son of God, but aimed too high. But they know what they're doing. They also know, because they're the ones that said, Jesus, show us a sign. He says, I won't show you a sign except for this, the sign of Jonah. The Son of Man will be 3 days in the belly of the earth, then he'll rise. They've just heard that report. And that's not enough to make them do anything other than throw out some coin and say, we'll spin the story so that we can keep this religion thing under our belts and make sure that this rumor of resurrection doesn't let loose in any way that messes with status quo as we know it. They become the deceivers. Well, that's how the story ends. Let's look at verse 15, because the soldiers take the money. Verse 15, so the soldiers took the money and did as they were instructed, and this story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this day. It's one of many explanations that are used, because the thing that I find very interesting about this story of resurrection in all four Gospels, and even when you see people wrestling with it just from a purely historical standpoint, as far as the Gospels want to say, there is one thing that's incontestable. You cannot deny it's true. And it's not the resurrection, because that takes a modicum of faith. It is that the tomb is empty. Everyone agrees on that. The soldiers, Pilate, the priest, the religious leaders, the disciples, they all have different perspectives on it and different ways to explain it. But all of them agree that this tomb is empty and Jesus' body is missing. If it were not empty, then all that would have to happen is the disciples could say he is risen and somebody pulls up a corpse and say, baloney. Baloney. It's not true. But this is one of those things that is so obviously true that what everyone has to do, whether they want to believe it or counter it, is they have to come up with a plausible explanation for it. They have to explain why is the tomb empty. What's wonderful about our text is Matthew's gone out of his way to make some theories to be less captivating than others. One theory of old is the resuscitation theory. And the resuscitation theory is Jesus didn't really die on the cross. He was near death, but he was, you know, being near death, nobody noticed it. They could hardly sense a heartbeat. They put him in the tomb. And while he was in the cloth, in this perfumes and spices, he resuscitated, came to, pushed the stone out of the way, fought the guards off, and then went to the disciples and said, I've risen! Which is crazy if you know anything about crucifixion. This is where Mel Gibson's The Passion does help us. Because you realize that story's not going to go too far. If you have been a victim of the whipping and the beating and the crucifixion, nobody's going to believe your story. And in fact, the fact that Pilate grants the body to Joseph proves that Jesus is dead. Pilate's a good statesman. He knows that threats must be dealt with. You don't almost kill a threat and then eliminate it. You make sure the threat is dead. And so one of the things we can't see as the explanation is this resuscitation. One of the biggest theories, especially during the Enlightenment, was the wrong tomb theory. That Mary and Martha and Peter and John, they all just went to the wrong tomb. And from that moment on, everyone just believed Jesus had risen from the dead. Now, it doesn't explain their encounters with the risen Jesus. You just have to say those are mass hallucinations and other such things. But at the end of the day, the wrong tomb, Matthew won't allow us to do that. And of course, one of the biggest theories to this day is the disciples stole the body. And Matthew's going out of his way to say that would have been very, very difficult. And even if they did, we know through history that all of them but John die martyrs' deaths. And the question that is always, I think, very, very interesting is, no one dies for a lie. If your life is at threat, you're not going to go to your death without saying, you know, we stole the body. One of them's going to do that. Turn tail. But nobody does that. They remain convinced that Jesus is risen and they've experienced him, seen him, saw him ascend, and are commissioned by him to go out into the world and make disciples in his name. So the guards, actually, all the efforts of Jesus' enemies end up being incredible ways to show that even their own spin can't be true. This is just a side note, but if you want to have fun with modern culture, you'll find that we get insulted with a lot of spin from all sides. And it's often not that very hard to discern. That's a lot of spin. And I think one of the things that does for us, you can complain about that all you want, and you ought to be concerned about that, but what it demands of us as the church is this should really be the no spin zone. The real one. Where we speak truth and love, where we speak the truth, where words matter, where testimonies matter, where what we say isn't spun in such a way that we guard certain things that Jesus might interrupt. That we are people committed to the vital importance of saying the truth with love. And so I think that's where at least we need to be cognizant. The other fun thing, and now I'm just kind of going off my notes. You ever want to have fun? I listen to both the right and the left. 95% of the time, the spin that the one uses on the other is just as true for the one saying it. Just listen, honestly. Play that game. Play that game and you'll hear the words that they're saying about the other side are actually very much true of themselves. Let's play that game. I play it all the time and it makes me go, wow! I need to listen to Rush again because that makes me peaceful. So the There's no confusion about the details. Everyone agrees the tomb is empty. That's why I would argue that one of the things that we can cling to and cling to with trust and confidence is perhaps the best explanation is He is risen. He's risen indeed. Obviously, that invites us into a new space. It invites us to a place that goes beyond history because no one ever sees Jesus rise from the dead. They are given that proclamation and they're told to proclaim that, and then they see the risen Lord. But no one sees this event happen. It's always the after effect of the event. And keep in mind, we are not the first people to ever think, you know, raising from the dead is crazy. It's true for every culture. Let me share with you this quote. It's so good by N.T. Wright. Don't be fooled by the idea that modern science has disproved the resurrection of Jesus. Modern science has done no such thing. Everybody in the ancient world, just like everybody in the modern world, knew perfectly well that dead people don't get resurrected. It didn't take Copernicus to prove that, just universal observation of universal facts. The Christian belief is not that some people sometimes get raised from the dead and Jesus happens to be one of them. It is precisely that people don't ever get raised from the dead and that something new has happened in and through Jesus which has blown a hole through previous observations. The Christian thus agrees with scientists, ancient and modern. Yes, dead people don't rise. But the Christian goes on to say that something new and different has now occurred in the case of Jesus. That we're talking about a transcendent reality, something of a whole different order, something not of this world and yet bringing redemption to this world. We're speaking of an event that lifts us beyond and into the life of Christ and ultimately into union with God through the Spirit. My favorite quote, though, by N.T. in this same commentary, says, if you're going to doubt whether Jesus was raised from the dead, it must be because you doubt whether the living God could or would do such a thing for Israel's Messiah, which is his way of saying it really isn't a matter of trying to think through it through our current scientific paradigms, which will eventually be old scientific paradigms. It is to say, if God exists, and if God is good, and if God is like Christ, could this God, would this God raise this Messiah? Particularly in light of how he lived and how he taught and how he loved. Could God do it and would God do it? And I have no hesitation saying God can and God would. So that leads us to our final reflections on this story because it'll lead us into next week's message. Two reflections, very quick. If you take into account all the spin that's going on in these stories, it seems like the powers of the world have triumphed. It looks like, on the surface, the troublemaker's dead, the powers that be have triumphed, and we may end up believing that sometimes, but Will Willimon, one of my favorite preachers, says, we've been indoctrinated to believe that there's no greater power present on earth than the Legion of the Empire. Our collective machinery of death makes perfect sense, and it seems to be the way things are. Unless the Easter testimony of the women is true. In other words, it looks like the empire is won. It looks like whoever has the power of death over others is always going to be the one that comes out on top. Unless their testimony is true. Because they didn't. They look like fools. Do the best you can. Secure it as well as you can. Do everything you could possibly do to make it so that there's no rumor of resurrection. And we see in this story, the religious powers, the political powers collude to try to prevent any rumor of resurrection as best as they know how, but to no avail. Because they can't stop a God who is able to undo what they feel is their greatest power, the power of death. And therefore, I end with this wonderful quote by Buchner. I love this quote. Buchner, Frederick Buchner says, how do soldiers secure the world against a miracle? It's like trying to stop the wind with the machine gun. Secure it as best as you can. Keep shooting into the wind. Maybe you'll stop it. You're not going to stop it. And here's the courage we could have. The movement continues to this day. What are we to do? How do we live this life, this newness? How do we embrace this testimony and walk in its way? What do we do about it? And guess what the answer is next week? The Great Commission. That's what we do as people who've been caught up in this story and share that testimony and go out into a world where the powers that be are going to keep spinning and spinning with the wealth and power behind them. And we come back and say, We want to make disciples, be disciples, baptize, teach, walk in the way of peace, knowing the risen Christ goes with us all the way. We'll look at the Great Commission next week. That'll be our final session. 78 sessions on Matthew. So we'll have to do something to celebrate it next week. Not sure what yet, but anything but a pie in the face would be fine with me. Kids, come on.